Well, hi, folks. This is Jack Spearco with another edition of the Survival Podcast. As always, one man's view of the changing world, the changing times, and the things we can all do to live a better life if times get tough or even if they don't. Today's Thursday, January the 9th, 2025. This is episode 3607 of the Survival Podcast. And as I like to say, after a long break, we are back and on the attack. This week was not a conventional week, but it's been a good week, and we've had some great content come out. But now we're going to be back into the true regularly scheduled programming, and that means this is Thursday. It's time for the Expert Council Q&A Show of the Week, episode 3607 this time around, and I've got a great lineup of experts. I want to tell you, too, about one of my favorite pastimes, my favorite TV show. You've probably never heard of it. I made up the name for it. Maybe you heard me talk about it yesterday. Demolition Dummies. I was afraid that this episode of Demolition Dummies was going to get canceled. Last night, it didn't look like we were going to get that much snow here. But I'm running a little bit late for a Thursday getting the show out because I spent a pretty good amount of time sitting with my wife watching the Cardinals and Snowbirds and Blue Jays and everything come in and eat all the bird seed she put out. That was what was out the window. And on the TV, we got to watch Demolition Dummies. If you haven't figured out what that means yet, those are people who do not comprehend what snow and ice are. And they think because they drive, let's say, big pickup trucks with four-wheel drive that they can go really fast, which they kind of can, but turning and stopping, yeah, that doesn't really help. We had a lot of people with maybe little Subaru all-wheel drives, and they think they can do that shit too, and they just can't. Because they didn't grow up like I did in the northeastern United States where we fled like snowbirds down here to Texas. They lived here their whole life, but it snows frequently enough. Every year, every other year, we get at least one event. Some years we get two or three. You would think they would learn by now, but no. I-35 overpasses, let's just see how fast we can hit that wall. We actually watched a guy this morning. I felt, you know, I make fun of this, but I actually don't want anybody really hurt. A little banged up. Maybe you learn your lesson. Your car banged up. Hopefully you learned your lesson. This guy, he came very close to death. His vehicle was over the edge of an overpass, and had he gone about another foot, it would have teeter-tottered and went down about 60 foot. So I'm glad that man is okay, but I hope he learned something in this year's episode of Demolition Dummies. And tomorrow will probably be, if you're in the Dallas-Fort Worth area, turn on local news, Channel 4, Fox seems to be the best at showing it. You might get a good episode tomorrow. Nothing to do with what we're talking about today, except it will trickle a little bit into Nicole Sauce's segment today. So what do we have today? Well, Dr. Ron Paul and Dan McAdams in a Liberty Report highlights for the weeks will tell you a little bit about how the left's newest target of hatred is Elon Musk. Not like they like the guy much, but now it's like instead of TDS, we have EDS, Elon Derangement Syndrome. Neither one of these people are my favorite people in the world. There's good and bad about both of them. But, boy, EDS is a special kind of mental illness. They'll talk about that a little bit. Dr. Kenneth Berry will talk about, yes, I said Kenneth. That's his actual full name. I have decreased it so. Is it true? I don't know, but I bet it is. Dr. Kenneth Berry will tell you why blood sugar can actually go down after you eat if you're metabolically healthy and eating the right food. I'll tell you why the individual that wrote the email in, though, is probably splitting hairs. With the absolutely tiny amount that the differential between the two readings were. Patrick Rohrman will talk about making a knife using a kit, like from KnifeKits.com, except still customizing it, still making it unique and special. Nicole Awesome Sauce will tell you about what to do when it gets really cold and you weren't fully prepared for it, or maybe the people around you weren't fully prepared for it. Nicholas Ferguson will talk about coppicing trees when that tree has never been coppiced before. The first time, is it a little bit more important to do it the right way? And I will go back to, I vastly prefer, for most things, pollards over coppices, but it works the same way. And then lastly, I came up with this recently. A completely different way to think about Bitcoin. And I've been in and out. Do I do it as a segment? Do I do it as a show? I'm going to do it as a segment, and then sometime in the next week or two or three, I will do it as a full show where we'll dig deeper into like the math behind it and all. But I want you to think about something. Humanity has been paid like dog shit since at least 1971, definitely since 1933 in some ways. 64 didn't help, 1913 didn't help, but 71 forward, 50 plus years, human beings have not been paid with money that recognizes the value of their labor. So what happens when there's a correction to that, but not everybody partakes in the correction initially? And things begin to restore themselves to a natural order where human labor is recognized for its value and is paid commensurate with a way that allows the value that's not used as a surplus to be stored. And the correction begins, but only some people are participating in the correction. You should be able to figure out where this goes from there. If not, don't worry. I shall cover it when we get there. Now, I don't have any sponsors of the day for you, but I got some really important stuff to tell you about right now that I want you to know about because, well, one of them, I don't know how the other one's going, but one's almost gone. I am doing on the fourth weekend of January, I believe it's the 25th, you might have to look at your calendar, but it'd be the Saturday, the last Saturday of January, a workshop right here, a little bit of biochar, a whole bunch about compost. We're going to actually build some bioreactors, do some things differently than we've done before. Assuming the weather cooperates, full details are on the site on what happens if we have to move it because of the weather. This is obviously for people that can drive in. I'd say if you're more than 3-hour drive in, probably not for you. I won't tell anybody not to do it. I'm just saying, because we have to be flexible, January weather can be 65 degrees. It can be 6 degrees. You just don't know. It can rain. It can snow. It can sleet. It can ice. It can be beautiful. So if we're going to have a problem with that day, we can either move it to the Sunday, move it to the next weekend, but we have to be flexible. But it's going to be a really cool workshop. It's only $50 a person. I'm going to feed the crap out of you while you're here. You're going to learn a lot. You're going to meet some cool people. And over half the tickets that are available are gone. Okay. The other one is the beef processing workshop that I'm going to be doing up at Crunchy Mama Farm. This is awesome. This one's expensive. But if you register soon, you get $100 off. And you're going to leave with about 50 pounds of grass-fed beef in a cooler. So you figure out what that's worth and subtract it from the ticket. And that's what you're really paying for the education and the experience. There's going to be 8 students per cow. So that means 1/8 of a beef minus what gets eaten for meals while we're doing the work. We'll go home 1/8 per student. Ken Daniels and I are going to be there. We're going to be like co-instructing and all. We're not taking the students' spots at all. We're there to help provide the service, provide the experience. So you get your full share. I didn't want to take any tickets away from the gentleman doing this. There'll be links in the show notes today to learn about both of these workshops with full details. I encourage you to register soon if you want to go. Again, this is about an hour north of me. I checked if you were to fly in for it, except you got to make sure you figure out how to get your food home. It's about roughly 45, 50 minutes from DFW Airport. So it's not far. Anybody local in the DFW area, no problem driving up to this place. If you're like in Denton or whatever, it's a short trip to your west over and you'll be right there. Again, full details today. Make sure that. Next up, Nick Ferguson's plant sale. He's got a lot of cool shit that he's never had before. Southern and northern blueberries, bush cherries, grapes, a whole bunch of stuff, plus the fodder trees, the persimmon, all of the stuff that he's always had, he has that, plus all the other stuff as well. And he is not a nursery that sells year-round. You have got to get what you're going to get ordered this winter. It will be shipped appropriate time in spring for you. And once it's gone, it's gone, and he sells out every year. You can find out more at rareplantstore.com, and there's a post about it on the survivalpodcast.com. All right, with that, kind of a long intro, but let's dig into it today with Dr. Paul and Dan McAdams on EDS. What is EDS? It's not a company, it's an illness.
Politico had an article, 13 times Musk meddled in politics. And what if they had said, 13 times Musk gave his opinion about political activities everywhere?
Yeah.
You know, one thought that I came across was this whole idea about Argentina, because he might have said something about Argentina. Then my goodness, I said something about Argentina. I sort of like, get him a yay in. And even after that, I supported him. Do you think I was meddling? An individual gives his opinion, and he's despised because he's successful and he's rich, and therefore they say he's not giving his opinion. But it wasn't just one time. He didn't give his opinion on Argentina and say, I think that's an improvement in Argentina.
Yeah.
It wasn't that. Politico say he's done it 13 times, given his opinion. So the question is, whose opinion, whose rights are being violated here?
Now, I saw this morning. We talked about it earlier as well. And I got very annoyed with the use of that word meddling. And you might say, well, that's being kind of petty. It's just a word. What's the big deal? Well, words are important because that's how we convey ideas, you know. And so when you use a word like that, it reminds me, and we talked about, I mentioned it too, it reminds me of when they started using the word disinformation. And everything that the elites don't like is disinformation, right? Everything that you say, oh, the shot doesn't work, disinformation, turns out it's true. So every time now that you give your opinion on foreign politics, that's meddling. Now, if you and I said it, as you point out, it wouldn't be meddling because we're not rich. He's richer, he has a bigger platform, and so they'll call it meddling because they perceive, his increased power by being wealthy. But, you know, it does remind me that the left needs its own hate figure. The right has done that a lot with Soros, too, I think, and we'll talk about it later, to some accuracy. However, the left needs and is trying to make Musk into this hate figure. Whereas, as you say, in effect, what he's doing, and he is a private citizen, now he's working with Trump, we know that. He's involved in the campaign, we know that. But he is a private citizen, albeit one with more resources. But look how Politico marks this. Go to the next clip here. This is how they characterize. And you can see the contempt just dripping from the Noah Keat is the journalist. I use that word loosely. This is a news article, supposedly. He starts it out by saying, Elon Musk just can't help himself. Oh, really? Okay. When he's not beefing with top Republicans, the ex-owner and Donald Trump ally likes to spend his time sticking his oar into the affairs of overseas governments to much annoyance. Here's 13 times a tech billionaire picked a fight with politicians outside the U.S. So it is not meddling to have a private citizen voice an opinion about a political party overseas, you know. But the way that he's writing it, it is exactly the way that Hillary Clinton lied about the Russians meddling in Trump's campaign. It was an absolute lie. But using that word delegitimized everything about the election in 2016. That's what they're trying to do with Musk. Now, we don't have to agree with his opinions. And frankly, some of them, I don't know where he's coming from. He's an unusual person. He can be a troll. He can say things we disagree about and disagree with. But nevertheless, this use of the word as if he's doing something nefarious by simply pointing out that Justin Trudeau is a dope, you know, and that Keir Starmer has a two-tiered policy, and we'll talk about that later. That is something that anyone with their eyes open would notice.
So a couple of things here. One, hatred from the left should be a badge of honor for anybody. Elon Musk, me, you, anybody. If the left hates you, that means two things. One, you're speaking truth, and two, you're effective. Because they don't care that you're speaking truth. They only care that you're speaking truth and effective because that's what damages them. So if you say a thing and the left doesn't care, it's either because you haven't reached enough people to cause enough impact or what you're saying is actually something that they have no problem with. That's it. Otherwise, you will be hated. That's number one. Number two, my actual problem with EDS, right, Elon Derangement Syndrome, from the left is making this like Elon Musk can just issue a fiat order and everybody does it. And you see how ridiculous this is when this really ramped up in this stage. Let's call this stage three of EDS. Like when he was going to buy X, it was ramped up. And then when he actually did it, it ramped up more. And now that he's like thrown in with Trump, this is like EDS 3.0. Okay. When the omnibus bill came out, and everybody's like, oh, we have to do it one more time. And Elon's like, this is bullshit, and he put that out. The huge numbers of Republican voters that called their congressmen and senators and said, if you do this, we will screw you hard. You will not survive the next primary. We do not want this. This is what the left said. You tell me if this is what the left said. Elon is the real president. Trump is actually it's Elon and Vance are actually running things. Trump's just there, right? Like, he can just do anything. He made some phone calls and he changed everything. He ruined the bipartisanship. But what actually happened was people that are on X tend to be more conservative than, let's say, people that are on TikTok and other social media. People that follow Elon tend to be more conservative. And Elon said a thing that most people who would call themselves conservatives, even libertarians who vote, Republicans, MAGAs, whatever, all in it, Everybody, by and large, agreed, this is a bad bill. We don't like this. A week later, he stepped in a shit of, we need more H-1B visa people. And most of the people on the right told him to go get fucked. Okay? When he threw in All In behind Mike Johnson, probably half of the people told him to go get fucked. When they really hate him is when his opinion happens to resonate with people with common sense. That's when the left always hates people. This is why they hate Trump. They don't hate Trump for the lunatic bullshit he spouts. Like, we're going to take over Canada and make it the 51st state. We all know that's bullshit. I'll talk more about that sometime next week. I know more about Trump than I care to admit, and I'll tell you the story of how I do next week. But it's when he says things like, you know what, if nothing else, we should deport illegal aliens who have committed felonies. Then they get really angry because even a shitload of like centrist Democrats are like, yeah, why don't we do that? John Fetterneck is like making more sense than a lot of Rhino Republicans right now. Like, yeah, I don't understand why there's a controversy about this. Right? That's when they get really mad. So that's the whole EBS thing in a nutshell. But I just think it's funny that they talk about Elon as though he can just wave his hand and everybody just goes along because he's Elon. He's the real president. But there are multiple instances of Elon going out to the MAGA crowd, the Republicans, the conservatives, the libertarians, and going, this is what we should do. And them all saying, go fuck yourself, Elon. It's almost like, oh, I don't know. It's almost like the left is a collectivist thought machine and the right isn't. The right actually has individuals with individual opinions who aren't afraid to state them. Which one of those sounds more like freedom and liberty to you? I can shit on the right a lot. It's just the right looks good because the left looks so effing bad because it is. Because it is. One of the biggest things, in my opinion, the left has done is convinced you there's a significant difference between socialism and fascism. There isn't. They're the same thing with different paint. And I don't care how many times your history or civics teacher told you the far right is fascism and all the way left is communism. They lied to you. They lied to you because somebody lied to them and they probably believed it. Anyway, moving on, let's go ahead and talk about your blood sugar changing to the negative after a meal. How does that happen? Dr. Kenneth Berry.
Hello, Jack Spearco and the TSP crew. This is Dr. Ken Berry answering a question today from Troy. Troy's question is, why did my blood sugar go down after breaking my fast and eating? So Troy bought a one-touch Vario Reflect, which checks your blood sugar, because he was wanting to check out if Gatorade Zero and other products like that would raise his blood sugar or not. Turns out for Troy personally, it does not. But he found something fascinating. He had a blood sugar of 99 before eating. And then he ate an 18-ounce ribeye and two small servings of broccoli and had some unsweet tea. And his blood sugar then went down to 89. And Troy is saying, what the hell? I thought your blood sugar was supposed to go up after you ate. And Troy, you're right in thinking that that is the usual common thing, because most people are eating a meal that's too high in carbohydrates, and that's definitely going to cause a blood sugar spike. But what many people eating a proper human diet find is that their morning blood sugar is the highest blood sugar of the day, and that after they eat a proper human diet meal, which yours definitely was, that their blood sugar will either stay the same, go up a tiny bit, or even go down. This is completely normal and fine. This is physiologically appropriate. This is not a sign of anything bad or wrong or dangerous. This is not pathology. This is physiology. This is completely normal. Nothing to worry about. So for all you guys out there who have a huge blood sugar spike after you eat, one of two things is either going on. Either you ate too many carbohydrates for you personally in that meal, or you just haven't given your body enough time yet to metabolically heal from the years of abuse that you were doing to it before you started a proper human diet. Hope this helps. This is Dr. Berry. See you next time.
So I agree with everything Ken said, but what I'll kind of point out in addition to it is, if your blood sugar goes from like 90, 91 to 89, 90, I look at that as no real change. A fluctuation of that level can happen. Like, you could literally check your blood sugar, wait 5 minutes, do nothing, check your blood sugar again, and you can have a change like that. That basically is a non-response, in my opinion. I also would tell you that it'd be interesting to me, since he has a one-touch, you know, monitor, to know, well, what was your blood sugar after you ate, 15 minutes after you ate, 30 minutes after you ate, an hour after you ate, 2 hours after you ate. My instinct is somewhere in there, there probably was a small uptick. He just didn't catch it. That at some point when his body was fully processing the meal, and you probably had a little bit of gluconeogenesis for the little bit of sugar the body actually wants, it probably popped 1 or 2 or 3 points above where it started out as a baseline. Maybe it didn't. I can't be sure of that. That's just my instinct. But I think there are certain numbers and measurements that you kind of throw out as in they're in like a gray zone where they don't really matter. And that would be weight, 1 pound or less, unless it's continuous over time. Like if you lose a pound and then you go a day, like when you're in a weight loss, you lost a pound a day, you lost a 0.2 pound yesterday and a pound the next day, then that pound was probably real. But if you lose a pound one day and you're back to normal the next day and you're back to where you were the day after that, one back down, you're going up one, down one, you probably didn't pee as much that morning, right? There are certain things when we are evaluating our numbers in any way that they're within what you would call in a poll, like for politicians, a margin of error. And I think when you're in a 1-2 point change in blood sugar, you're within the margin of error. And it's less error. It's probably an accurate number, but it has nothing to do really with what you did. It's just that nothing really happened, and that number is going to move around 1 or 2 points all the time anyway. All right, next up, let's hear about making a knife kit into a more custom version of a knife than just what you would get out of the box if you just did it the way that it came. We'll do that with Patrick Rohrman.
Hey guys, it's Patrick with MT Knives coming to you today with today's Expert Counsel segment of the week. Today's question comes from Andrew. He says, is there any way to change the finished look of a knife? I'm looking to build a knife from Knife Kit. The blade that I like comes in a satin finish 440C stainless steel. I would prefer the look of a black stonewashed D2 steel. What can I do to achieve a similar look? Thank you for your help, Andrew in Texas. Thanks for the question, Andrew. So in order to stonewash a knife, we need to get a black finish on it first. And the way you go about that depends on the steel itself. But the process is pretty well the same. You might have different results with different steels. The difference that you're going to use is the type of asset and the duration of the etch. We're going to start off by cleaning the knife real well. Some of the supplies you're going to need, you need PPE, so some like latex gloves, safety glasses, long sleeve shirt, that kind of stuff. Any kind of PPE that you would use, because you're going to be working with acid and you want to keep from getting it on your skin or in your eyes. You also will want some acetone or something to clean the steel to get any grease or oil off of the blade. You're going to need an acid. A lot of people use ferric chloride acid. I believe you can also use like muriatic acid. With high carbon steels, you can use an acid like vinegar. It doesn't require such a strong acid. But with the stainless steel, you need to use an acid that's a little more aggressive. You also are going to want some string, a stick, a container to etch this knife in. So we're going to start off by cleaning the steel with some acetone and a paper towel. Be sure to wear some gloves and just give it a good scrub down, get any oils that may be on the steel off. The cleaner the steel is, the more consistent the etch is going to be on the knife. So what happens a lot of times is if you don't get the steel cleaned properly, when you stick it in the acid, it's going to be, your results are going to not be, they're going to be blotchy, or there's going to be spots that don't take the etch. Some people will actually put the knife in the acid, pull it out, scrub it, put it back. So you're going to have to make a solution of the acid. You're going to have to dilute it down. Now, some people do just go ahead and etch the knife in pure acid. If you try to use pure acid, you're not going to have as much control with it. So I would suggest doing like a 3-to-1 mix or a 50-50 mix. what that's going to change is the amount of time that you have to leave the knife in the acid. Whenever you mix up the acid, you want to put the water in your container first and add your acid to the water. Keep that in mind. We're going to add the acid to the water. We're going to mix it up. And then you'll put your knife into the acid. Now, some people will just stick it straight in the container. I would suggest tying a string to it and then putting a stick or something across the top of the container that's going to hold, that's going to suspend the knife in the solution. If the knife is leaning against the side of the container or flat in the container, it may not get an even etch. By hanging the knife in the solution, you're going to help get a consistent finish. It also makes getting the knife out of the container when you're done easier. The etching process can take hours or even days, depending on how strong your acid solution is. With the 50-50 or, you know, the stronger solutions, it's going to take a lot less time, but you're going to have to be careful not to over-etch your knife. I've heard of people sticking their knife in the solution and pulling it out, and a lot of the knife is dissolved. So you don't want to do that. That's why I would suggest starting out using like a 3-to-1 ratio, and then put it in the solution, come back, check it in a half an hour, check it in an hour, check it in 5 hours and 10 hours. You're going to kind of know right away how fast it's etching. With a 3-to-1 solution, it could take up to 30 hours to get a good etch on some steels. Once you've achieved the desired darkness of the steel, you're going to have to pull the knife out of the water and clean it off, being careful not to get acid on things. And then I like to neutralize that acid with a base, something like baking soda. Some people will use Windex, but you want to pull the knife out, neutralize it, clean it off, and get that reaction to stop. And then you might want to go ahead and oil the blade. So once you have your knife etched, now it's time to tumble your knife. There's many different ways to achieve a stone wash finish. I personally have a vibratory tumbler. It's not necessarily the cheapest option, and I've purchased media for stone washing knives. And there's a plethora of different type of media, size, shape, and abrasiveness to give you a wide variety of finishes. But this can be done very basically with something like a Gatorade bottle and rocks from your landscaping. You want to get your Gatorade bottle or some kind of container that's big enough for the knife to fit in, and place some rocks in it, place your knife in it, fill it probably halfway full of water, and add a little bit of soap to it. And then once you have the rocks, the water, the soap, you can suspend your knife in the bottle, still on a string, which will help you get it out, and then screw your lid on and give it a shake. Now, we're not trying to kill it. You know, you don't have to get super aggressive with it. Just a light shake, and it helps to do like a circular motion when you're shaking this bottle. So you're going to want to stick the knife in, shake it up for 5-10 minutes, pull it out, clean it off, check it, see what it looks like. And it will take some trial and error. A lot of it's going to depend on the rocks that you use, the steel that you're using, and whether or not you're going to get a look that you're going for. So as you can tell, this process can be very simple or very complex. And with a lot of things in knife making, knife makers do a lot of experimental stuff. You learn by the experimentation of trying different things. So Andrew, thank you for your question. I think this is a great project for you to try something, experiment with, see how it goes. And it's going to give you something a little more unique than the run-of-the-mill knife kit on the market. It'll help your knife to stand out and look different from the rest. So I appreciate the question. Feel free to send me your questions at patrick@mtknives.net. Also, I'll work on a video on how I stone wash some knives. I'll probably stone wash some Talon knives for you guys, and you guys can see that process too. So thank you for the question. This has been Patrick Rohrman with MT Knives. Have a great day.
Good stuff from Patrick, and it's something that I think more of you guys should give a shot to. You know, people have asked me, like, well, how do I do? Just try it. Yeah, it's the same advice I give people. Like, I want to take my kid fishing, but I really don't know a lot about, you know, learn enough to know not to use a bobber the size of a softball for a bluegill. Get an appropriate sized hook and a split shot and go find a park pond and just go fishing. Because it's the first trip with the young kids, probably in the last 30. Just go try it. 30 minutes and you'll be done anyway. They feed the take some bread and feed the ducks, right? And then keep going and you'll learn more. And I kind of look at making a knife from the kit the same way. Just make one. You know, they're not that expensive. You can get a decent knife kit for under $30. If you screw it up, just make another one. It'll be okay. Just consider it like paying a fee to learn. And then that will make your life easier. Another way to look at it, when I went to the Food Forest design, it was like an intensive with Dave Jackie for Helena, Montana. And it was a class, but we were also actually designing different schemes. And one of them was actually used to actually put the first public food forest in Montana in a park in Helena. And I was on a team. You know, we broke into like four teams to do this. And one of the gentlemen that was on my team, my group of designers, actually had a degree in landscape architecture. And one of the things he did that really made our group able to flow was he said, you see this, like, tracing paper we're using over the plot to map things out. Do you know what they tell you to call this the first day in landscape architecture school? Trash. They tell you to call it trash because then you're just free to design, and if it doesn't work out, you just get another piece of paper. Don't feel like because you drew this thing here, it has to happen now. Just let go. And I think that a lot of things in life, maybe they're not quite that simple, but they are that simple in a way. And I think things like learning a new skill set, as long as it's not like you're going to go, you know, dive with sharks with ribeyes tied to your back, you can probably take that approach. Next up, let's talk about it's going to get cold or it got cold and you weren't fully prepared with Nicole Sauce.
Hi, Nicole Sauce here from the Living Free in Tennessee podcast. Hi. It's cold. Are you cold? I'm cold. It's really, really, really cold, especially if you live in the part of the United States that doesn't get cold like this very much. And much to my chagrin, there's white fluffy stuff that has fallen from the sky. And in some places, as I understand it, it has also dropped some of that harder, slippery, icy stuff on the ground. And it's just there. And you know what that means? It's cold. You know what happens when it's cold and there's wind and there's snow? You know what happens? Especially in parts of the United States that don't usually get that. And listen, Backwoods Butcher, I don't care if you know how to handle the snow. In New Hampshire, we're not in New Hampshire. You know what we are? We are here in these places where we have moved so we don't have to deal with the white, horrible, icy world that can happen. And yet, it happened. You know what? We're preppers here. And so it's always funny to me when we go into these snowstorms and these icy seasons and then the power goes out to get all of the questions about what to do next, how to keep the livestock water from freezing, how to keep warm. Okay, you know what? Even the most prepared person can overlook stuff though. So I'm going to give you guys a pass, and I'm also going to admit from time to time I have ended up in situations I should have totally been prepared for and was not prepared. So here are some tips from the South about working through cold when you don't have to deal with cold infrastructure for months on end. And the first one I have is livestock related. You've got to keep your livestock watered and fed. The first thing is give them more food if you're feeding them, because you know what? The extra calories will help them generate the energy to keep themselves warm. And of course, you want to keep them out of the wind, not getting like rained on. But what we've discovered is those rubber watering tubs at Tractor Supply freeze more slowly than a lot of the other solutions we've used for watering. So while, yes, we have a rabbit waterer that circulates the water and it keeps it from freezing, and it's great, and I have a video for that on YouTube. I'll give that link to Jack. Just putting a rubber waterer in there with your rabbits or your sheep or your chickens slows down how fast it freezes. And then you can go out from time to time if it's really cold and dump out your cool round ice cube and start all over with some fresh water. That's something I've done for many years, and it's one of those, it is what it is. We haven't figured out how to keep the water from freezing, so we'll just keep them in fresh water. Little extra work from you for you, but not the end of the world. Two, coffee. Yeah, I said coffee. I said what I said. Holler Roast is my business. I love coffee, so I can't imagine going into this cold time without being able to enjoy a beautiful cup of freshly made Holler Roast coffee while you look out your window from your warm home into the cold tundra that has become the outside. And so, I will say this. If your power is out, here's how you can make coffee, even if you don't have any crazy generator to give it electricity or whatnot. In fact, I almost consider it a waste of your time to electrify your coffee maker in this situation, because all you gotta do is make water hot. Now, those of you who camp probably have a camp stove. So boil the water, and if you have a drip maker, you can just pour it through the top of your drip maker with the filter in, and that works. Or if you don't want to do that, take your filter and put it into your canning cone or whatever else, and you can do a drip coffee like that. Like, basically any way of suspending a coffee filter with coffee in it will help you make coffee. Also, if you have a French press, you've already got this figured out. You just got to make the water hot, right? You guys got it covered. If you're a K-cup person, first of all, you can buy your K-cups at hollerroast.com. Secondly, I mean, you should probably have a backup plan, because pulling those little pods apart and pouring the water through, while it is possible, it actually isn't as good as putting it through the K-cup thing, because of the pressure that builds up in there from the K-cup thing. But if all you have are K-cups, you need to do surgery. And what you're going to do is you're going to pull all of those K-cups apart and combine your bean, like your groundy grounds, into something that you can make into coffee. Now, some ideas from here. If you don't have coffee filters, but you do ferment stuff or make sprouts, and you have one of those lids for a mason jar that has like a mesh screen, you can put the hot water in the mason jar with the grounds and then pour through the mesh screen. You'll still get some like chewy bits, but it won't be too bad. If you have a tea ball, that works. That works. If you have a paper towel or a cheese straining cloth or a fabric napkin or a 100 thread count pillowcase, any of those things will strain coffee grounds out. Also, if you want to cowboy it, just put your grounds in water and stir it and let it sit for a bit, and you can drink that just straight up. Some people add eggshells. They say that it makes the coffee grounds like fall to the bottom. I haven't experienced that myself, so I'm just going to give that as a suggestion. They also say that salt works, and if anybody has tried those two methods, let me know. I haven't tried them. Anyway, I know I've just talked for 100,000 years about coffee when the grid is down, but coffee is very important to me. It makes my whole day better. And when I know the rest of my day is going to be dealing with keeping animals and humans alive without any power, cooking stew on my wood stove or whatever, you know, it's worth the time investment. Let's talk about making water hot. If you can make a fire outside, then you can make water hot if you don't have any of these other methods. But most of us have a grill, a camp stove, some other way to boil water, and then it's no problem at all. Okay, let's talk about the third and really important thing, and that is keeping yourself and your family warm when your primary heating source has gone out. This is for all y'all who heat with electricity or gas. And, you know, the electricity goes out before the gas, but sometimes the gas also goes out. If that happens, the best thing you could have done was, like, last year installed a wood stove as your backup plan. But, you know, maybe you didn't do that, right? And now you are in your home with no wood stove and you have no electrical power. If you have a generator and you have an electric blanket or a heating pad, you actually can use that to create some warmth, just as an aside. But the Big Buddy propane heater is a really great thing to have as a prep. It's like $140, and then a couple of those, you know, you can get an adapter for the 25-pound propane tanks. I think that's another $80 or so when I bought it, and that works great until it doesn't work. And then you need to make sure you have 1 pound green propane tanks on hand for that, just as a backup to your backup. That's a great way to heat. Kerosene heaters are, it's hard, you know, we were talking on the Tuesday Live this week. Hard to find kerosene, absolutely true. But kerosene heaters work in a pinch. They work great. They're more efficient dollar for dollar on fuel. And you can also, well, you know, store them and kind of abuse them, and they do pretty well because there's not a lot of moving parts on a kerosene heater. However, they create a smell most people don't like. So that's sort of, like, I used kerosene here when we first lived here 18 years ago and didn't have any other heat. I didn't mind because I was warm, but some people really do mind. And then those of you with asthma may not love either of those solutions. Both of those you want to be careful with in enclosed situations, just because you don't want to end up accumulating, you know, carbon monoxide or whatever and make yourself die. Yeah, so make sure you ventilate if you use something like that. Other ways to stay warm are to reduce the size of the space you need to heat and bring everybody into one room, lots of blankets. If you're in a really, like, seriously bad situation and you didn't have any other way to heat, you can bring candles in or other things that generate heat, and do your best to stay warm. Body heat does a lot. Sheltering from the wind and keeping dry are the things that are most important. Again, if you're a camper and you have a tent, put your tent up inside your living room and get in your tent with all of your warm weather backpack hiking gear, for example. That reduces the size and you get the body heat going, and that can help you go forward. But while you're sitting in that tent, bored out of your mind, hello, text message. Also, take some time to think about what you can do in your specific situation for the next time this happens, because all of this advice does not matter to anybody right now who's in a situation where they're not prepared. So if you find yourself in a situation where you're not prepared, 100%, write down what's frustrating, what's uncomfortable, what you want to fix. Come up with some ideas of how you could have things on hand that are available and something you would want to have in your life to make it better next time, because it may not happen for another 5 years, but it's going to happen again. Like, it's going to be cold again, right?
Yes, it's cold, and the dog agrees.
Anyway, just keep that list in mind, and then make a roadmap to build your preparedness plan beyond that. Because every time we have an experience like this, it's actually an opportunity for us to see where our preps are not as good as they should be. Anyway, those are my thoughts on the horrible cold weather that is hitting us, that has hit us, and that will hit us for the next little while. Welcome to winter, my friends. If you're interested in jumping in on my Three Things webinar, which is free, it is actually tonight, Thursday, the 9th of January. You can sign up at NicoleSauce.com. It starts at 6 p.m. Central. If you are listening to this on Saturday and you're like, fiddlesticks, I missed that, no problem. Just go sign up at NicoleSauce.com. The recording of it's available for 7 days. This is a way to create a roadmap to build your life the way you want it to be, to build the life you choose on your terms, as well as to cut through the crap so you know what to focus on to make yourself more successful and happier as you move forward. Make it a great week, and stay warm.
Good stuff there on the coffee stuff. I did add some links in the show notes for some things that Nicole mentioned. One, she mentioned a French press. We use a French press every day. I really love it for general making coffee. Like, it's our go-to. In fact, we have two large ones and one small one. And I'm very happy with the brand we've selected. We've had them a long time. Nothing's ever gone wrong with them. So I have a link to the French press I recommend there. On the tea infuser thing, like little tea balls and all, I actually recommend a tea infuser. I haven't actually brought it around as an item of the day in a long time, and I probably should. It's made by a company called For Life, and it's fairly large. If you put it in a standard-sized coffee cup, it actually will occupy most of the space, but it won't do it in a way that disrupts your ability to put liquid in it. It's like a big cup with a very fine sieve in it. And it's great for making teas, but it's also great for making coffees. Sometimes I want like one cup of coffee. Dorothy don't want any more coffee that day. I will just get like a standard sized coffee cup, throw that thing in it, throw a heaping tablespoon of coarse ground coffee into it, pour hot water over it, makes fantastic coffee. They're about $30, but this is a lifetime purchase. They're wonderful, and it comes with a little cover. So when you're making teas or anything with lots of oils in it, it helps that oil not evaporate on you, which keeps the flavor, and it reconstitutes on the lid and ends up back in the cup. It's totally worth it, and it's incredibly fine sieve. It's also something I use a lot in making like herbal infusions. So I see it as a multitasker. Lastly, I have not reviewed one yet, but I did finally buy one after being harassed by you guys forever, you coffee freaks. AeroPress, and specifically the 3-in-1 model. I love it. A review will come soon. And so there's a link to the one that I bought in the show notes today as well. With that, now let's hear from Nicholas Ferguson on coppicing a tree for the first time, and he'll tell you a little bit about his plant sale as well.
Hey there, Nick Ferguson from Homegrown Liberty and RarePlantStore.com here with an expert counsel answer for Donald on coppicing. He says, for Nick Ferguson, can you cover when and how to coppice your first year bare root poplar and willow trees? I ordered some bare root willow and poplar trees from Rare Plant Store, and they are growing great. This is the first growing season after planting, and now the trees are about 10 to 12 feet tall and approximately 1 to 2 inches in diameter at the base. If I want these to be coppice trees, when do I make the first cut? I'm in zone 9 and expect the trees to grow till probably November or so before it gets cold. Sorry if you've covered this in the past, just wanted to make sure. Thanks for the excellent bare root trees. Don. Well, I know you sent this a while back, man, but I saved it for now because it just so happens that now is the time to coppice. I know you're in California, so the trees are unlikely to really go fully dormant, but you basically want to wait till it's the coldest week of the year. You want to wait till the trees are dormant before you cut them all down. I'm going to be coppicing all of my mulberries and willow and hybrid poplar as well here in just a few days. I still have leaves on a lot of trees despite having some frosts already, but after this week, they're likely going to be as dormant as they are going to be this winter. So this weekend is going to be the time just because it's cold. So yeah, all you do when it's time to coppice them is pick a height above the ground, generally an inch or two off of the soil level. You can cut wherever you want to be completely honest. I have some that are cut at 18 inches off the ground, some at 6, some at 8, just to see what would happen. They're all doing fine. The ones cut at ground level do fine. The ones cut an inch or two with just a little bit of stump left sticking out of the ground, they're doing fine as well. Just whatever works for your situation should be fine. Cut it down to a stump and turn the top into wood chips or biochar to add back to the soil. Or if it's hybrid poplar or hybrid willow, you can take everything from this past year's growth, and more than that, really, and turn them into cuttings for more trees. There's nothing magical about it. Don't worry about hurting them. I've lost some due to insect or disease pressure, but for the most part, they all bounced right back in the spring. If you're apprehensive about it, give them another year or two of growth before you coppice. Thanks for ordering trees, man. I hope they serve you well for many years to come. And speaking of which, remember everyone, tree sale is on for this year. We have named cultivars of elderberries, bush cherries, a trio of fantastic grapes, seedless grapes, fodder tree packs as normal, dormant cuttings of willow and poplar. I think I'm almost out of the poplar. Strawberries, blueberries, both northern and southern cultivars. Raspberries, blackberries, kiwi berries, and figs. Oh, and the pack that I'm actually really kind of stoked about is a pack I call Bacon Trees. It's the first 3 overstory carbohydrate producing trees that I am using for long-term fattening tree crops for livestock. I plan on finishing pigs on mulberries in the summer, acorns in the fall, and persimmon in the winter. Can you imagine how good that bacon will be? And if you're not into the baking thing, then how about beef finished like that? Cold smoke a brisket, slice it just like bacon, just as good, if not better than bacon. Fantastic. Check them out before they're all gone. It's day 9, I think, when you hear this, and I'm about half sold out of all my stock already. So go on over to rareplantstore.com and check them out. I'm Nick Ferguson. Do good things.
And just a reminder, if you want to get yourself some fodder trees or some other cool stuff, Nick does have a really awesome sale going on at Rare Plant Store right now. Now let's go ahead and let's talk about Bitcoin in maybe a little bit different of a way than you've ever heard it before. Let's talk about Bitcoin today in a way that maybe you've never thought about it before. And we're talking about just Bitcoin for this subject, though silver and gold are going to come into this a little bit. But like many of you, I have seen various memes over the years that show how devaluing the currency has devalued human labor. And you usually see it as something to the effect of, here's 5 quarters, this was the minimum wage before they demonetized silver out of our coinage. And today, if you had this much silver, it would be worth 30-something bucks, and this would, the minimum wage would be $35 in value, not necessarily dollars. And I've seen that over and over and over again. And I've always really thought it was actually a very powerful concept. But it wasn't until my winter shutdown, in between, you know, the beginning of Christmas through New Year's, that at some point I saw somebody post something in that vein again and something clicked for me. And I'm going to bet none of you have ever heard anybody talk about Bitcoin this way before. Digital gold, sure, yada, yada. But a different concept about the adoption of a new store of wealth and monetary instrument that is Bitcoin. An absolute scarce, enforced by network, absolute scarcity as a means of storing value or being paid for your value. So I don't think people really grasp the meme we started off with about the quarters sufficiently, so I'm going to start there. So for most of America's history, from our founding up until, I'm even going to let the Federal Reserve thing go, except we did have that whole crime of 1873 with the initial demonetization of silver. But even 1913, if you actually look, everybody always wants to start the graph there because we all, with justification, hate the Fed. But, you know, the dollar's lost 99.98% of its value. So go back to 1932, right before FDR revalued gold at $36 or $33, whatever it was, versus 20. And did that big devaluation. Go back just before then, and you'll see that the inflation, supply and demand, because supply and demand hits different commodities at different times, but the actual inflation rate between 1913 and 1933 wasn't really that big a deal. It was that decoupling and then fractionalizing the gold value against the dollar and revaluing gold where the big dip hit. And but then if you look at that, from 1933, again, eliminate the supply-demand curve on different commodities and the effect of World War II and all, through the 60s and into the 70s, inflation was not great, but it wasn't that bad. But go to 1971, baby, when we finally said the hell with any anchor whatsoever. 1971, and that was where the majority of inflation occurred. And if you go and you look up the site, what the fuck happened in 1971, you can see that when we went full fiat everywhere. Administrators versus teachers. Administrators versus doctors and nurses. Seed oils. Fiat food. The value of housing. The cost of an education. 1971 is where everything went to shit. So that's a little over 50 years now. For a little over 50 years, human labor, human effort, and when I say human labor, I'm not talking like a communist here. I don't mean you showed up and sat at a desk. I mean actual productivity, whether you were running a business or working for somebody, you were receiving fiat in return for the value you were creating. And this fiat, the stated goal is to devalue it by 2 to 4% per annum. That's per year, for those that don't speak big words. And the Federal Reserve's actually been pretty decent at it. There's been times where it's got away from them. It's been upward of 8, 13%. But in general, 2 to 4%, they've been able to do that. And it's cancer. It's cancer to the value of your surplus energy. So you get paid, you spend a certain amount of money to do things, and then you save a certain amount of your money. And humans have been forced into first mutual funds, then ETFs, as investment schemes to combat inflation. They actually sell it to you that way. The financial liar comes to your work and says, you should invest in this, and if you're young, just go crazy, put as much as you can in the most risky shit possible, because over time it'll work out anyway. And these markets have been propped up. I actually authored an article while I was in shutdown mode. You can look it up on the site, and it's about how an experiment has been done many times where people have thrown darts at stock sheets and outperformed professional money managers, because the whole thing is an artificially inflated thing. And that is because your surplus labor is now going into this money market, or not money market, this investing scheme that values companies at far more than their production is worth, and it can only be fueled by printing money. But what that really means is that you, when you are compensated in dollars, are being compensated in a faulty currency that will devalue over time. Meaning if you just take your money and you save it, you are paid, let's say, X is your labor rate today. Tomorrow you're worth more money than today if you get better at it, so you might get X plus. But doesn't matter, because whatever you're saving is X minus. You cannot save your way to wealth in a fiat system. You can't do it. That's why we all have investments, whether we invest in real estate, we build businesses that have underlying equity value, we buy gold, we buy silver, we buy stocks, we buy mutual funds, we invest in other commodities. Whatever we do this mainly, we take the risk, because that risk is less than the risk of simply storing the money. But again, this is all because you've been compensated with a faulty method of delivering value back to you for the value you put in. Okay? Now, let's think about this as a new monetary instrument that is Bitcoin. Genesis comes in, what was it, 08, 09? And there's very little adoption. And then about 2010, 2011, you could actually go buy it on an exchange. You could store it. People started using it. People started sending it back and forth. People bought pieces with it, whatever. And some adopters early on said, wait a minute, not only do I think this is a freedom technology, not only do I think this is a method of payment, and as all the shitcoins came out, some people had more clarity than even me and said, that is a shitcoin. This is the thing. And they kept some of it. And all of us got the price we deserved, and we got the price we deserved for the initial Bitcoin we bought or we received as payment, and we got the price we deserved for the Bitcoin we didn't fucking spend. Now, as you introduce this is the part I don't think you've probably ever heard before. As you introduce this new monetary instrument and it begins to get adopted, okay, you begin to have this new form of currency adopted. All of a sudden, even if you're paid in dollars, if you're doing what I teach, which is sweep your surplus capital, if you're not going to buy an investment with it, if you're not going to pay a bill with it, if you're going to hold it as cash, and you're going to hold that cash more than a year or two, put it in Bitcoin. And people begin to do that. The system that is out of order, the disorder of economics created by a fiat currency, begins to correct. And people begin to be paid, even if they're paid in dollars, by converting the surplus to Bitcoin. They have made a decision, I will be compensated in a non-faulty currency, a non-faulty monetary instrument. I will have a better battery to store the value of my labor. But here's the thing. We have, you know, young people that have been doing this 5 or 6 years, and they've managed in that 5 or 6 years by being good ants to stock a pile 2 or 3 Bitcoin. $200,000 or $300,000. Now, no matter how unfairly compensated that person is, do you think, I mean, you're talking about people that are, you know, middle income earners, maybe a little bit on the upper side of that, you know, but they're people with tech jobs. Some of them are people that change tires for a living. I'm not putting this down. I'm just saying, is that job worth $100,000 a year or $200,000 a year that some of these people have amassed? The answer is no. The answer is no. So how simply by, like, is it just an investment scheme? No, it's not. It's a correction. But the people in the correction are receiving the correction en masse. In other words, all the people that fail to adopt this strategy are giving up their right to reclaim what they have lost. And so the person who was in this by 2015, 2016, 2017, and has consistently sweeped that surplus capital in, isn't just recapturing the unfair wage that they were paid. They're doing it with everybody else's, because everybody else is still living in the fiat fantasy. And this is indicative, okay? This is indicative of what happens when a new monetary asset is adopted, or when an old monetary asset, which is our, you know, our oldest monetary assets are silver and gold. I should say our oldest lasting monetary assets that are still used are silver and gold. And silver and gold have been used and then devalued and then reintroduced. And whenever this happens, the people that get on board with it first tend to have the greatest benefit. But why? Again, I say that the real reason is that the correction is now being intercepted by the early adopter. In other words, I'm not just recouping the value of my labor, and I first started working about 1985. I'm not just recuperating my labor from 1985 to 2025. And the value of every bit of value I've put out in the world by adopting this new system of wealth storage, right? I am intercepting my father's and probably my grandfather's. Anybody who was working prior to, after 1971, the whole damn world, it's all up for grabs. I know that sounds a little crazy. I'm going to go deeper into this. I'm going to put some math behind it. I'm going to put some spreadsheets behind it and stuff. And I'm going to do like a full-on episode about just this, or maybe a split episode. It's half this and half something else in the next few weeks. But I wanted to drop that on you today. You're seeing a correction in the robbing of the value of human labor. And again, do not let the term human labor confuse you to be something like Marxist, communist, socialist mindset of human labor. You showed up, you were there, and therefore you're entitled to your equal share of what the person who risked everything to build the company you work for. No, I don't mean that. But I mean that you do bring some value, or nobody's going to pay you, unless you work for government anyway. You could just hold down a desk for government, or a big enough bureaucratic company that's living off the tit of government and the tit of fiat. But if somebody hired you into a business that has like 12 employees in it, they're going to notice. They're going to notice if you're not contributing, and they're going to get rid of you one way or another. They'll either fire you or make your life so miserable you'll quit. It's better for them if you quit than if they have to fire you because of fiat mindset and government and interference and workers' comp. And trust me, if you've ever employed somebody, you know what I'm talking about. If you don't know what I'm talking about, you won't until you employ somebody. So that's a better way to get rid of somebody than outright termination, is to encourage them to go elsewhere. And that's what happens to people that don't. But if you are kept, you're working for a small business, you know, whether you're busting tires or writing code, you have value. And I will tell you that most people, even though they think they're underpaid, aren't. You're being paid your market rate. The problem isn't the amount you're tendered that week. It's the value of what you were tendered that you didn't spend, what you used your own self-discipline to not take resources from others, to put it aside for later, the value of it in 1 year, 3 years, 5 years, and 10 years. That's the flaw. And so the longer you wait to correct that, the less of the correction you get. Right now, those of us who went first by taking the risk, we got everybody else's correction up to this point. And we're going to keep doing it, and it's up to you when you start doing it. That's just kind of a new way to think about Bitcoin. Again, this is from episode 3607 of thesurvivalpodcast.com. If you're watching me live, it'll be about 30 minutes before that whole episode's up. Lots of cool stuff in it today. Anyway, with that, I'm out, and I'll talk about this more in the future. All right, and if you want to share that, there'll be a link in the show notes today if you want to share just the Bitcoin segment there at the end. With that, I do want to wrap up. Thank you for tuning in today. We, like I said, we are back and on the attack and back to our regularly scheduled programming. And that means that tomorrow will be a Friday flashback. Monday will be a Just Jack show. Tuesday will be a Just Jack show. Wednesday will be an interview. You know where I'm going with this. We're right back to where we were. I want to encourage you guys again to consider coming to one of the two classes that we're going to be having. One of those classes, again, right here on my farm, fourth weekend in January on the Saturday. Full details in today's show notes and on the website. There's a full write-up on it. Or the beef processing workshop at Crunchy Mama Farms, about an hour north of me, maybe 45 minutes north of me, depending on traffic, weather, and how fast you drive. And we're going to be processing two full beefs, and you're going to go home with an eighth beef in a cooler. So factor that into the cost, and it's going to be a hell of an experience. It's about 2.5 days, hands-on, and being with some really cool freaking people. So definitely check that out. And also consider our item of the day today, same one as yesterday, is the Frontier Organics chili powder. Man, all you got to do is just trust me. It's a cheap product. It's like $13 for a pound of it. It's all organic. Cut the bag open and sniff it, and you'll go, I'm never buying McCormick or whatever random-ass chili powder you buy again. I don't care that this costs almost twice as much per ounce. It's chili powder. It's not a sports car. It's not that expensive. This stuff is the best I've ever used. It will change your cooking. I tell you exactly in my write-up on it how to make the chili the way that I make chili. I also dispel this myth that real chili does not have beans in it. You sound like an idiot when you say that, especially if you're from Texas and you think it's a Texas thing, because Texas isn't the only place where we say that stupid shit. It's not chili because there's not beans in it. It's chili that has beans in it. Like, if you it would be chili, but you put beans in it, so it's not chili anyway. It's just a stupid statement. It's one of those arrogant things. It's like military units that, like, talk shit about each other. You're a pogue, and yeah, and you wouldn't eat if we didn't cook your fucking food, and you wouldn't have anything to shoot anybody with if we didn't give you your bullets, right? It's dumb, and it shouldn't be done. And I'll tell you the truth. The original chili probably was more beans than meat. What, Jack? This is crazy. You've lost it. No. Hold on, purist. You want to be a purist? You want to make the original chili? You're a cowboy. The year is 1878. You're on a trail between San Antonio and Dallas on a horse. It's going to take you several weeks to get where you're going. You're paid to move cows, not to eat them. They're incredibly valuable assets that somebody else owns. Do you think you just shoot one every day? There's about 8 guys plus a cook on your team. How long is a cow going to last? You know, that you've processed. How long do you think you have to process? You don't have that much meat. What you have is dry goods. Dry chili peppers and beans. I'm not advocating you go make a pure bean chili. I'm just telling you that home on the range chili was probably mostly made with dry beans because it was cheap. It kept you alive and it didn't spoil. And you weren't allowed to just go popping cows in the head with your colt every time you wanted a steak, because it didn't make sense on the range. So that's just a little ad that I didn't plan, but I don't know, it irks me when people say dumb things, even if I agree with the outcome. Because to me, real chili today, modern chili, I like it all. Well, I don't like it all beef. I like it all meat. And some other things, peppers and stuff like that, obviously. But what I also like pork in my chili, and a special kind of pork. What kind of pork is that, Jack? Some of you know, because you already read the article. Some of you know because you know how to make good chili. Some of you don't. Go read my write-up, even if you don't want to buy the Frontier Organics chili powder, even if you're already using, because a lot of people are like, I already use that. I knew about Frontier Organics because of you. Okay, great. You still want to know how I make my chili, don't you? The only way you're going to find it is go read it on the website. With that, I'll catch you tomorrow with that Friday flashback, and we'll be at it again on Monday.
You should have a house the American way. A dollar down, a dollar a month, and you never have to pay. There's a better way to do this. Let me show you a better way.